Gonna go back in time.
Gonna go back in time. Gonna go back in time.
Searching my mind for some truth to reveal. What thoughts are fantasy? What memories real?
Resume. Noun. 1. A summing up. Summary. 2. A brief written account of personal, educational, and professional qualifications and experience. Mike's Amazing World of Comics is an invaluable resource, and without a doubt, this podcast wouldn't exist without the site's much-lauded newsstand feature. But it is not perfect. Once you get beyond the big two publishers and bygone majors like Dell, Western, and Harvey, things tend to slip through the cracks. Obviously, Mike has to be mindful of mission creep with an effort of that scale, which means magazines tend not to be within the site's scope. I thought about some items that I previously touched upon in the Number Zero episode, and wanted to expand upon them a bit before we pulled too far from their genesis point. For instance, I was a casual buyer of Scholastic's Dynamite and Bananas magazines, although I don't recall ever seeing them on a proper newsstand. I assume that they were geared more towards subscriptions, likely offered as part of an ordering catalog circulated in grade schools. Before the internet, the most valuable resource for information was the library, but they often were not geared toward the pop culture ephemera that beguiles a child. Book fairs were typically your best shot at actually having a say at what books got into your hands that wouldn't necessarily be found elsewhere, which is likely how I completed runs to that date of book series like James Howell's Banicula. Scholastic was clever in that their catalogs were available throughout the school year, hawking their publications, where there was probably only one or two book fairs in a given school year. They seemed to have a monopoly on that particular racket. Anyway, I never went in for Scholastic's magazines, since a subscription was a heavier financial investment than an individual book, and I could never be sure how long my family would reside at any given address. It occurred to me while wrapping up the previous episode that I gave few biographical details in this period. My recollection of most of the comics mentioned was that I bought them from the neighborhood 7-Eleven that was my earliest base for collecting, where my grandmother lived. However, we shouldn't have been living anywhere near her in that time period, so I presume that we were in South Houston or Pasadena, possibly in an area with limited newsstand availability. Whatever the case may be, I don't recall much of where we were in 1985, so I sure couldn't tell a postman where to go. No, I typically bought Scholastic magazines at Woolworth's, the place where non-returnable periodicals went to die. A perfect example is Bananas number 31, which announced on the cover, "Hello Shelley, goodbye Kate." This would be laughable today, but the cover was two separate headshots of Shelley Hack and a small inset Kate Jackson against the light pink background, announcing the swapping of actresses on the television series Charlie's Angels. I was familiar with the show from UHF reruns, which I think ran at midday, so I only likely saw it when I was out of school. I would have bought the magazine around 1983, but the original run of the show wrapped in 1981, and the magazine announcing the casting development was from 1979. What did I care about a half-decade-old actress swap on a show I rarely watched? And yet, it was a cheap humor magazine that I know went home with me. Being so dated was a much greater liability to Dynamite magazine, which was basically people for the pediatric set. It's possible that I might have picked up a Gary Coleman cover feature from 1979 because Arnold Drummond was still on my TV in the 1980s, but Donnie and Marie and Shields and Yarnell had no such carryover relevance. I doubt any of the ones spotlighting Star Wars or E.T. were remandered to Woolworths, but even new, Dynamite would have the blandest takes possible. I most likely went in occasionally on the oddities, like the Amazing Randy going off on paranormal chicanery, or Universal Monster Spotlight from one or two generations of childhood before mine. Wikipedia says it lasted into 1992 with 165 issues, but I assumed it had already passed by mid-decade, because its personal relevancy was long deceased. Dynamite had a lame superhero comic strip, the trademark infringing Dynamic Duo, which was barely a step above the TSR-80 Whiz Kids giveaways at Radio Shack. Bananas had a healthier shelf life than Dynamite, if only for offering a greater and better variety of artwork, instead of publicity photos and vapid text. As a humor magazine, it was less tied to a specific time period, and offered competition to its more established contemporaries. Bananas was in full color on heavy paper with cardstock covers, so there was immediately a greater sense of presentation and permanence than a flimsy mat or cracked. These magazines were in black and white on a stock just barely upgraded from actual newsprint, and the covers were always the first thing to fall off while reading. They were also thicker, which meant more content, but not necessarily more quality. Bananas had some really swell artists, and sometimes painted colors. Plus, they were less likely to go for lowbrow sexist or gross-out humor. I specifically recall 1984's Bananas number 69, featuring a photo cover from the TV detective series Remington Steele. It was a bit of a cheat because Mad would have a Mort Drucker painting instead, but it was still fun that Scholastic had access to actual production stills or promotional materials to skewer. In this instance, Stephanie Zimbalist thinks she's posing for Time magazine, while Pierce Brosnan has a thought bubble deciding not to spoil her fun by telling her it's only bananas, as she'll find out sooner or later. The back cover was a photographed parody of a soap called Swallow that cleans you from the inside. As a middle-aged man, that now seems less like a joke than an intriguing Shark Tank pitch. This might have been the one with an illustrated Oscars parody that teased Sly Stallone for his less than intimidating stature and Jennifer Beals for being a non-dancer starring in Flashdance. It may have also been the one with a two-page menu for a restaurant called Burger Sty, which means I have to walk back some of my statements on gross-out humor. As I've mentioned previously, I never vibed with Mad Magazine. I always found Alfred E. Newman to be off-putting, the logo boring, and the departments felt rigid. They had the older, more prestigious talent, but the humor to me always came across as mean-spirited and old-fashioned. They were very enamored with barf bags, big ethnic noses, fat jokes, and the art styles trended toward political cartooning. I randomly bought a few 70s issues at a flea market mid-decade where they went hard on the gas shortage and the Poseidon Adventure, which meant nothing to me. I guess Spy vs. Spy was alright. The Sergio Aragonés doodles weren't really my style. Al Jaffe's fold-ins were nifty. And for some reason, I was drawn to Dave Berg's The Lighter Side Of, even though that definitely had a conservative old man shouting at clouds bent. I tried to uncover specific issues to spotlight, but Mad did so many repackaged editions of various themes in a variety of formats, like movie specials and paperbacks of strips, that sorting it out evaporates my interest. Scanning through covers at mycomicshop.com and Comic Vine, I was able to pick out a familiar few from the 80s. July 1986's number 264 featured Hulk Hogan on the front, and the parody Moon Fighting. There's a feature on Rambo's expanding influence on media, including a shirtless George H.W. Bush dropping the other F-bomb, Full Got, and comedian Nancy Walker offering Bounty paper towels as the quicker picker-upper in the aftermath of a patriotic bloodbath. Another edition that stood out for me was April 1987's number 270, featuring Alfred as a Bruce Springsteen stand-in. Rather than committing to one long movie parody, they did a sort of medley of The Color of Money, Peggy Sue Got Married, and Jumpin' Jack Flash, the latter being the only possible motivation I might have had for picking it up. What can I say? I stand Whoopi Goldberg. Alternately, there were mock lottery scratch-offs on the back cover that you could really scratch off to reveal gags. Maybe that's why I never picked up the habit in adulthood. Cracked was plainly derivative of Mad, down to the logo and early cover treatments, but for whatever reason, it was more my speed. I had to Google Sylvester P. Smythe, their janitor mascot, who lacked the charisma of Obnoxio the Clown and the name recognition of Irving Forbush, but was inoffensive and unobtrusive. He would be on the covers, but as a featured item, rarely the sole focus. Most of the covers were painted by John Severin, a more classical comic artist who adapted to humor, making his strips feel more grounded in satire than broad parody. Bill Ward brought the va-va-va-voom, so I shouldn't have been so surprised when I stumbled upon his prolific fetish art very slightly later in life, though I had to stifle the urge to write in a letter with a nudge-nudge-wink-wink to that discovery. Like Mad, Cracked sometimes felt like the old artist's retirement home, but I got more of a kick out of the occasional Steve Ditko oddity than some 50s EC crank with a hot take on Boy George. And Cracked broke a lot of new talent that I would come to appreciate, like Bob Fingerman, Milton Knight, Bill Ray, Peter Baggy, and even Dan Clowes on The Ugly Family. Cracked was gentler and more apolitical, but also felt looser, weirder, and more diverse in its humor. I think Mad was more of a closed shop of men of a certain age and lifestyle, who kind of all knew each other and formed an echo chamber. I've always been a bit gun-shy about caping for Cracked, but the more I look into it, I dare say it was a better magazine than Mad in the 80s. No wonder Don Martin jumped ship. I do have a memory of reading Cracked by the apartment swing pole at night while Invisible Touch by Genesis played on somebody's boombox. The humor magazines always feel like summer reading, something I'd grab when there was nothing better to buy, or because they had more content when I had too much time on my hands. Lord, I wish that was still a problem I had to wrestle with. One of the easiest ways to put me in a funk is reminding me of how little time I have left in this life to accomplish all the things I still want to do, with the increasing likelihood that I simply won't. It's like the last week of summer when you know returning to school is imminent, except also you'll die and maybe go to hell. I mean, I don't believe in hell, which I figure would be a big part of the problem, and I was wrong enough in school to acknowledge my potential to flunk the afterlife.
Have mercy on me. You treat me so bad, I'm in misery. It's breaking my heart, can't you see? Baby, baby, have mercy on me.
But But speaking of going back to school, especially the library, I was recently reminded of another couple formative books. The World Encyclopedia of Comics, edited by Maurice Horn, was released in 1976. It was a tall, fat hardcover featuring the yellow kid on the front of the dust jacket, John Romita Captain America on the back, and an extraordinarily cool shot of the Italian criminal by Magnus and Max Bunker. The same image of Felix the Cow is on both for some reason. It's about 783 pages of encyclopedia entries with numerous comic panels reprinted on each page. The young cannot appreciate how precious encyclopedias were to us prior to the internet. Seeing this reviewed on Comic Book Kayfabe was a bit of a mind bomb, realizing how many early features I was first exposed to here. Where else would I have seen a sample Little Nemo in Slumberland, or Crazy Cat and Ignatz? Actual manga images, as opposed to common import anime like Speed Racer. There's a panel of Takeo Saito's Golgo 13, years before we'd be properly introduced via the Nintendo Entertainment System. There's even some European erotica with several images of not-so-mild nudity and bondage by Greedo Creepax. And yet I definitely had access to this in the elementary school library, something I checked out repeatedly, though not as much as the great comic book heroes, since it didn't reprint full comic strips in color like Pfeiffer's edition. Also, Jules Pfeiffer clearly differentiated between comic books and comic strips, with an emphasis on superheroes, where the World Encyclopedia just pulls everything together. A color section featured a splash page of Doctor Strange in his brief blue mask period, from an issue of Strange Tales I owned at the time. Make me feel just a tad more worldly. I obviously have to get a personal copy of this now. The heavy presence of comic strips also puts me in mind to collected editions that were popular in the 80s that you could get in school and at the public library. They used to do these little paperbacks of stuff like Peanuts, BC, and The Wizard of Id that I could pick up cheap at flea markets. I remember praying to God to win a game of musical chairs so that I could claim a stuffed Hagar the Horrible, and I did. Garfield and Bloop County were personal favorites, though in the dog days of summer, I could make my way to Doonesbury, as if I had an ounce of political awareness at this point in my life. I mean, my grasp of President Ronald Reagan was more informed by Saturday Night Live than the nightly news, so how was I going to process references to Henry Kissinger or Hunter S. Thompson? Anyway, what brought this all up was my buying well-worn hardcovers of Superman from the 30s to the 70s, and the only contemporaneous release, Jeff Rovin's The Encyclopedia of Superheroes. Superman Collection, and its sibling Batman one, were almost all comic book reprints mixing majority of black and white with some color. This was a book that you'd turn in and it would be checked out for the next 6 months until you get another turn. I wonder how it would have affected me if they had done a Wonder Woman one. And why didn't they exactly? Anyway, Rovin's Encyclopedia plays even looser with its premise than Maurice Horn. They apparently couldn't license the rights to any actual superheroes, so the painted cover by Vincent Defer alludes to mythological deities, Arthurian legend, spacemen, and Caped Crusaders. Adam Strange and Marvel's Zorro-Lif El Aguilar are on page one. Carrying on, you have representation for much of the entries in DC's Who's Who and the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, plus indies like First Badger, Dell's Brain Boy, AmeriComics' Femme Force, Don Simpson's Megaton Man, Gilbert Shelton's Wonder Warthog, TV duds like Captain Nice, pulps like Conan and Doc Savage, cartoon novelties like Super Chicken, the mythological Heracles separated from the mass media Hercules with a nod to Steve Reeves. The color section offers Fat Man the Human Flying Saucer, Power Records Hollow Man, Captain 3D, and Hallmark's Super Pickle. This thing has five appendices, including one devoted to the names, powers, and debut appearances of heroes created by Robbie Reed's H-Dial. The others for teams, short blurbs for the extra obscure and minor, as well as deep-cut Golden Age heroes, plus a section on the Forerunners. It's only about half as long as the World Encyclopedia at 425 pages, but the next time someone asks me how I know so much about comics, I'll have to give Rovin a shout-out. He produced a sequel on supervillains with an early Cologne cover in 1987, but I don't recall seeing that one in its day. In 1984, I bought, new from previews, his catalog of adventure heroes, which had a greater emphasis on action movies, westerns, and serials. But that one didn't have near the same impact. I'm a bit perturbed to see it commonly listed for under $10 when I paid about twice that 29 years ago. So much for my pull box discount. That took longer than I expected. I'll probably have to turn this episode into some sort of summer special instead of trying to cover an entire season on top of this. Plus, July 1985 alone has a lot of formative books to address.
And we'll be swinging. Yes, we'll be swinging. Little Charlotte, she's as pretty as the angels when they sang. I can't believe I'm out here on the front porch in the swing, just a swinging.
I'll need to take a moment to orient myself. The gap between my buying comics from this period new and a few years after as back stock is narrowing, and I technically haven't written a blog post for this project in nearly a decade, with age assuredly a greater factor in my recall capacity. I'm pretty sure All-Star Squadron number 50 was in 1988's Grocery Sacco Comics, but it was conceivably in a 1989 quarter bin as well. Either way, the draw was a tie-in to Crisis on Infinite Earths, and not the hoary old coots that populated that book on the monthly. I specifically remember checking out the archival covers at the back of the book, and there was a time years later when I became very invested in DC history. Even at its peak, I doubt I could have slogged through a book this drab for continuity minutiae so immediately irrelevant. More assuredly in a bin was DC Comics Presents Annual No. 4, a much better looking book thanks to the combination of Ed Barreto and Jerry Ordway, but even less a consideration with its tale of Superwoman and pre-Crisis Luthors plagiarizing the Savannahs one last time. Nathaniel Dusk 2 No. 1 was the second time I would start and not finish a miniseries, starring the eponymous Depression-era private investigator by Don McGregor and Gene Colan. If more than two issues of either had been in the bins, maybe things would have worked out differently. I gave the year-long Vision and the Scarlet Witch maxi-series a toss now and again, but the Richard Howell art and excess of recaps were such turnoffs that it was never a contender. My half-brother had a mild interest in Fire Lord, the Herald of Galactus with the flaming Q-tip, so he probably had a copy of either Amazing Spider-Man number 269 or 270, but he didn't care enough to have both, and I didn't care enough to keep track of which. The debut issue of the year-long Eternals was definitely something I flipped through on the newsstand and never touched again, beginning a lifelong disinterest in that property. I think Alan Kupperberg gets a bad rap in general, but it probably didn't hurt my opinion that Mark Farmer inked him on Blue Devil number 17. That said, he's a bit too straight for the lighthearted misadventures, leaning too seriously into a Crisis tie-in, revolving around the fishermen and seemingly sentient raindrops. For reasons unknown, I skipped or was deprived of the following issue. Brian Boland's Black Book number 1 definitely got fished out of the cheapy bin for the reliably sumptuous art, but a child of the 80s was only going to get so much out of color reprints of British anthology lifts of 60s Hammer horror tropes. By choice or not, it swiftly left my possession. ElfQuest number 3 made it home with me, but whether from dwindling interest or availability, a large gap followed. I knew I remembered Wolf Portasio inking Arthur Adams at some early point in their careers, and there's no other embellisher to obscure that fact in Longshot number 2. Both admittedly improved by leaps and bounds from this point, but there's something about the dark edge Portasio lends Adams that is never recaptured after this. Again, I read my brother's copies of the miniseries, most likely in 1986 or 87, but it was still scarring. Longshot stumbles into a job as a stuntman, and when he's grievously injured on the job, the director discreetly dumps his body in the bayou. I remember well the year-long press coverage of the tragic deaths on the set of the Twilight Zone movie, and while John Landis remains one of my favorite directors from that period, I retain a great deal of animosity toward his smug face to this day. It's not hard to see the parallel Anna Sinti was barely reaching for, and there's even a passing physical resemblance, although he's clearly amalgamated with Spielberg and Lucas. The third issue of Longshot also supposedly shipped this month, though that's difficult to fathom with the level of detailing going into every page. You can really see the influence Adams had on J. Scott Campbell and Rob Liefeld in these early efforts. Not that either artist ever reached even this level of craft. The story is a twisted take on It's a Wonderful Life, where Schlamazel tries to take his own life but lands on Longshot's floating body. The alien has some sort of healing factor and proceeds to demonstrate his inherent obscene good luck on a misadventure where the Schlamazel takes every knock. In the end, he's so battered and disaffected that suicide holds no more interest, as he'd rather return home to the suddenly desired voices of the nag and brass that first drove him to the attempt. Crisis on Infinite Earths number 7 is assuredly a prime collecting memory, for the month, year, and ever. I never cared a lick about football, but I'd managed to grow into, and would quite soon at this point grow out of, a Houston Oilers winter coat with a blue breast, silver sleeves, and red cuffs. Some teenage girls were running the counter at the Mall Walden Books, and thought I was so cute with my Nicholas Bradford haircut that they gave me a copy of the double-lengthy issue featuring the death of Supergirl. I took the copy with me on a Greyhound bus ride from Houston to Colorado Springs to visit my stepfather's brother's family, the occasional comic fans for whom I'd gotten and never returned that Spider-Man team-up treasury. I think the younger brother held a grudge, because he was nasty toward me the rest of the time I barely knew him. Anyway, the sci-fi scale and air of tragedy from Crisis permeated my action figure play in a way Secret Wars never had. The art by George Perez and Jerry Ordway was incredible. I got a primer in essential DC Green Lantern lore, and was introduced to scores of new characters in the best possible presentation within the minuscule space. I've read enough entertaining Maid of Might stories not to diminish her by calling this her best, but certainly there are a few superhero deaths that still resonate as much as this one. The less effective but longer lasting death of Barry Allen, the Flash, in the next issue was part of my buddy's grocery sack bounty. After a brief lapse in Webhead interest, I came back strong for the all-new, all-daring Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man number 107. It was a pretty mean feat for semi-disgraced swiper Rich Buckler and that one moonlighting guy from marketing working under Marvel's only African-American editor. The story would end up revealing the death of Jean DeWolfe, a literally disposable, gender-swapped Commissioner Gordon at a time when Spidey's main squeeze was a Catwoman lift. The amount of blood and the framing of Captain DeWolfe's murder were so shocking that I remember showing it to my comics disinterested girlfriend for her take on the matter. Daredevil shows up partway through, and the tone of his title seems to be borrowed as well. Jim Owsley will catch all kinds of hell for his bold new direction, but he was on to something with his Peter David guy. And anyway, Owsley would eventually literally make a whole other name for himself as Christopher Priest. Unbeknownst to myself, Dreadstar and Company number 5 presented the penultimate issue of that newsstand reprint series of the 1983 Baxter format direct sales only title. While still plentiful in its violent action and advancement of plot, it will become a welcome comic romp by the midpoint, necessary after several uncommonly bleak issues. Marvel Age Annual number 1 had the novel and likely costly idea of having the creative teams of most of their current comics produce a single-page story to advertise current events in their titles. This was followed by mostly text-only teasers for upcoming events in those titles and the broader Marvel production slate. I read my brother's copy at a later date, which I suppose was my first taste of intentionally watching commercials on YouTube that I gladly skipped when they were actually airing on television. Having just touched on Marvel Age, this is another area of neglect on my part. I believe the title was direct market only, but as noted with regards to the first DC sampler, I had a weakness for advertorial content and occasional access via flea markets. I think I pulled 1983's number 8 out of a quarter bin in 89, featuring caricatures of Stan Lee, Jim Shooter, and the Marvel bullpen. I think my half-brother had a copy of number 16, with a Bill Sienkiewicz New Mutants cover. And I know he had number 22, with John Romita's Saul Brodsky Memorial cover. Clearly beloved within the halls of Marvel, and with perspective offered in the issue, but possibly one of the least commercially sound moves possible. Relevant to our current coverage, Bro had June 1985's number 27, with an Al Milgrom cover, both as renderer and subject, as part of a feature on Secret Wars 2. This was one of the earliest issues to feature a back cover calendar offering cartoons and significant dates for comics fans. Loath as I am to acknowledge it, by August of 1985, we're past the halfway point of Secret Wars 2. We've done the Everyone Wants to Kill the Molecule Man issue, the Peter Parker Teaches the Beyonder to Poop one, the one where the omnipotent being tries to buy hookers and private investigators with solid gold buildings that immediately perilously collapse, and the ones where he becomes a horny yuppie with a dyed job wearing Michael Jackson's cast-offs. We're pioneering the contrived cameos in every title of the line for months, even Transformers, making Millennium look restrained by comparison. With this month's number 5, we see our moping demigod hopelessly devoted to Dazzler, and the world is gifted Teenage Mutant Boom Boom. I must insist that I never read any of this dreck, only flipping through my brother's copies. Jim Shooter always struck me as straight edge, so I can't come up with a consciousness-altering substance that would have made him think that The Man Who Fell to Earth was a sound basis for a mega crossover. Yet another 1985 title that I need to briefly touch upon is Squadron Supreme, Marvel's alternate universe dystopian superhero maxi-series that predated, and some say informed, Watchmen. I mean, they're both riffing on famous half-century-old Aldous Huxley and George Orwell novels, but sure, I won't be referencing Watchmen here for some time, if ever, as I didn't read it until the mid-90s. My brother bought copies of the much less regarded Mark Gruenwald, Bob Hall, Paul Ryan epic, which I found to be so crushingly boring visually that I never even attempted to read a single issue. It's basically what if the JLA did an identity crisis in the Bronze Age, and even with these dollar store analogs, not Batman is still the hero against the oppressive forces of not Superman. To me, it takes the worst elements of Elseworlds, which were already reheated what-ifs, and Dan Didio's them into actual if-distaff continuity. No thanks. Yet another 1985 oversight was the comics adaptation of the NBC television series V. These had a neat, if minimalist, ad campaign exploiting the spray-painted V logo, and I would occasionally spy them in the mall bookstores. I was and remain a huge fan of the first two television event miniseries, and some of the covers were nice, but I could not stomach the late and lacking career-low art by Carmine Infantino. I've come around to a lot of revered Silver Age greats that were in no way my speed as a child, but Infantino's appeal is still largely a mystery to me. I see a lot of George Tuska in his work, but I prefer Tuska, and I'm not that big a fan of his either. I'd already tried and swiftly abandoned the ongoing single-season TV series, and the comic was a supplement to that, playing out somewhat like a newspaper strip. I did pull one or two of these out of the quarter bins a few years later, but they were consistently disappointing mistakes. The post-apocalyptic relaunch of the weird Western hero Jonah Hex had an even better ad campaign, but even worse market penetration. I think I saw it every once in a while at the mall, but not consistently, and never making it to the register. A final overview before returning to monthly coverage for Star Comics. The Marvel Kitty imprint began in 1984 with the comic book adaptation of The Muppets Take Manhattan. Continuing with the Jim Henson licenses, Fraggle Rock had a brief run under the imprint. Comic strip icon Heathcliff fared better, lasting 21 issues. The proper launch with original characters was at the start of 1985, offering a sci-fi take on Richie Rich and Planet Terry. I pleaded poverty, not buying an issue until a local shop offered copies for a dime each in the 2010s. I might have tried Wally the Wizard at the same time and rate. Top Dog wasn't even that lucky, missing me entirely despite a desperate Spider-Man guest appearance. It was obvious that Marvel was trying to take on other publishers for the dwindling youth market, recycling the look and talent from companies like Harvey and Archie, but Royal Roy was a bit too blatant. Where most of these non-starters played out a year's worth of leash, he only rated half that length. I dabbled in some of the Star license fare, though Strawberry Shortcake didn't quite make the cut, and the Marvel creations lacked even her scant appeal. But I did give them a toss at the convenience store, so I figured they rated some mention. And I think the Hickman Secret Wars brought them into some semblance of continuity. A lot has been made of the new universe's failure being tied to the dimming of Jim Shooter's star ahead of his dismissal in 1987, but I do wonder if his absence also killed the publisher's support of their baby branch.
By mistake, a couple walked into a bar where a motorcycle gang hanged out. They started coming on to his bride, slapping him all about. They were buying drinks for the house and using his money to pay. But it was
last call for alcohol. Go ahead, make my day.
Oh, we'd love to hear him say, go ahead and make my day. Just stood in the door of the 44 and said,
go ahead, punk. Make my day.
With all the catch-up comic book coverage, I figure we need to locate a stopping point within the more or less single month of July. Heck, some sources have the Jeff Roven book released in October of 1985, so we're all over the place this time. Things will also stay a bit fuzzy for the period media recap, because I'm going to do some more double dips and flashbacks here as well. On the TV front, there are several notable series ending over the summer, but I'm going to defer Voltron and Master of the Universe coverage to another episode. Dungeons & Dragons wrapped on CBS, which I caught irregularly but liked. I also had at least War Duke from the mostly unrelated action figure line, but it got stolen very quickly. The Electric Company took its final bow, but aside from the Spider-Man segments, the show didn't hold my attention coming out of Sesame Street. I watched a little Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids, which ended a run dating back to 1972. A much less fine vintage was Matt Houston, starring Lee Horsley from The Sword and the Sorcerer, Pamela Hensley of Princess Ardala fame from Buck Rogers, and Buddy Ebsen of Beverly Hillbillies and Barnaby Jones. Horsley had a lesser mustache than Thomas Magnum, but bigger hair and a southern drawl. He played a bored oil baron who decided to moonlight as a private investigator, so definitely some 1970s ridiculousness carried over into the new decade. Both of the leads were dead sexy, and the show was exciting and fun. Plus, it repped Texas, and Horsley was totally my mom's type. I was sorry to see it go after three seasons. July of 1985 saw the launch of Nick at Night, wherein the kiddie cable channel Nickelodeon would give way to classic comedy reruns for an older crowd in the evening hours. This marked the shift of a lot of older sitcoms from local UHF channels to cable, particularly after Nick spun off the all-day network TV Land in 1996. The Ethiopian benefit concert Live Aid was a big deal that summer, and very much a part of my burgeoning social conscience, but I didn't watch much of the actual broadcast. On to the movies, I feel like I gave Breakfast Club short shrift, so I wanted to detail it a bit more. I missed it theatrically, seeing it broadcast in 1987 on a Las Vegas affiliate. I loved and related to it immediately, and it holds up better than most of John Hughes' work. During a rewatch decades on, my buddy Jose Fixit pegged me as the basket case played by Ali Sheedy, but I always figured myself more a mix of Judd Nelson's Bender and Anthony Michael Hall's Geek. Meanwhile, every girl I know was obsessed with Madonna and adopted some element of her personal style, so I was very aware of desperately seeking Susan without actually seeing it. Gymkhana's mix of gymnastics with the martial arts craze was another one of those period elements that's mostly remembered for its promotion more than the product itself, like dubbing every second sequel Electric Boogaloo. As mentioned on a previous episode, I came late to Back to the Future. I don't recall seeing it theatrically, and it probably was a slow build in my consciousness. I have a vague recollection of a novelization coming my way, And the first girl I ever got naked with loaned me her copy of the soundtrack on cassette. I either lacked the resources or the technical ability to dub my own copy. I want to say my viewing waited until we got a VCR in 1987, which just seems insane to me in retrospect. Weirdly, there wasn't anywhere near the schoolyard chatter for this one as Ghostbusters and Gremlins, both of which also waited until VHS, so I didn't feel any social pressure to seek it out. Too bad, as it's easily the best of the three, a movie considered perfect by many. I didn't watch Family Ties or Taxi, so the stars weren't in my eyes. Maybe somebody should have told me that Beverly from Howard the Duck was in it. I may have instead seen Red Sonja at the Dollar Show, or maybe video. It wasn't memorable enough to recall such particulars decades on. Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome was definitely an EP recording off HBO, passed to us by a family friend. My half-brother was a bigger fan, as he loved quoting,
"Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dying times here."
I hadn't yet sat down to see The Road Warrior in its entirety, catching bits and pieces on TV. And it was all so macho and aggressive for my tender sensibilities. Who runs Bartertown? Not Master Blaster so much as We Don't Need Another Hero, the Tina Turner single that hit me harder than the movie which spawned it. I think Life Force was also an EP recording rather than a conscious rental, and it was seminal. I was watching it with my stepfather when the energy vampire played by Matilda May offered her full frontal nudity while descending a staircase, sending a bolt through my body in general, and probably specific regions in particular. I was still a bit too young for such a slow-burning British sci-fi horror spectacle, but between the upfront titillation and the sprinkling of cutting-edge monster special effects throughout, it held my attention. The Fall of London during the finale is another prime example of why zombies, even only functional representations of such, became such a fascination for me. A definite late 80s rental for me was Subway, an early Luc Besson French-language film starring Christopher Lambert. I was fascinated by a white-haired Highlander wielding a lit fluorescent light like a blade, but the movie fell far short of my vague expectations. I want to say I saw Disney's The Black Cauldron with my mother at the cinema and liked it well enough at the time, but my only last memory was Bizarro's John Byner lending his voice to a furry pet of the lead character, always on the lookout for
munchies and crunchies.
She also was quite fond of the stacked Western Silverado, which we saw at the Dollar Show and repeatedly on video. Less enamored, I remember her viewings in passing more than my own. Explorers was a family outing, trying to tap the E.T. market. I liked it, and the cast was solid enough, but not one I revisited much afterward. The Man with One Red Shoe was a cable viewing and not a committed one. The Legend of Billie Jean eventually got rented, but the real prize was the related Pat Benatar single Invincible, though I'm honestly most familiar with a cover in her style for a movie hits cassette I had. Dr. Otto and the Riddle of the Gloom Beam got a lot of TV ads with Jim Varney playing his familiar Ernest P. Worrell character, but it was such an oddity that I'm uncertain to what degree I was exposed to the actual film. I grazed the Heavenly Kids somewhere, possibly as deep as a theatrical viewing, or as shallow as the omnipresent ads on back covers of comics coupled with some television viewing. Kiss of the Spider-Woman I don't think even made it that far, but my brain still glommed onto the title for the misperception of a Marvel tie-in. National Lampoon's European Vacation was an edited TV viewing, probably on UHF.
I talked to the man in the moon. I said, "Sir, is she coming back soon?" He smiled and he stated, "Son, I'm overrated. I've had too much credit in those old love tunes. I don't know a thing about love. I just kinda hang here above. I just watch from the sky. Will love grow? Will it die? I don't know a thing about love."
A final development that's messing with the show's format, country music was a major crossover success in the early 80s, and I listened to it as my default until 1987. However, Western music has left the Billboard Hot 100 by this point, and when I tried to check out the country exclusive chart, it was behind a paywall. I'm going to make a special effort to represent the Western charts that I can access, even if I have to reach back months earlier than the current episode's subject to do it. A lot of my favorite music in the genre never topped the charts, while Duke Boy John Schneider's Vanity single did. Take this as my apology to the non-kickers who wondered what the hee-haw was going on with the music, especially after I explicitly referenced Tina Turner and Pat Benatar. In general, I hope to talk more about music as we reach toward 1986. See our resume? 21st Century Boys, Avery East, Batman Crime Solver, Between the Pages, Bree, Charlton Hero, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, Constellation, Dana Rubber NYC, Ed Moore, ElfQuest, Hannah the Endless, hashtag Sandman Season 2, History of Comics on Film, Hicks But Look for Flanger in the Refugee Camps, Iowa's Joe Is, Irredeemable Shag, Jeffrey Brown They Them, Jocelyn Johnson, Kalima Lieberman, Marvel Universe Online Project, Randy Caldwell, Satin Tights Wonder Woman Podcast, Surrender Artworks, Siskoid, Superbound, Tim Price the Podcrasher, and Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast. With a final note from Illegal Machine, I 100% instinctively sang along to the Muppet Babies theme here.
Searching my past for the things that I've seen. Is it my life or just something I dream?